Hello, everyone, and welcome to Podcast Creators, a show where we get podcasting advice from real podcasters. If you were just checking out the show for the first time, hit that follow button. How hard is it to create an investigative true crime podcast? What skills do you need? What type of equipment do you need? How do you know if the show's any good? How can you stay true to the case, the victims, the families, and also get decent performance on your podcast? We're going to learn about that and more. Today on the show, we have Catherine, Karen, and Gary from The Reporter's Notebook, creators of the popular investigative true crime series named Still. Today's interview was recorded on Riverside FM, so if you like the way this sounds and you want to check it out for your show, I would appreciate it if you use my affiliate link in the show notes below. Speaking of links, I will put all the links to Still, plus the links to all the tools and equipment we talk about down in the show notes so you can check that out. All right, let's go. Karen, Gary, Christine, welcome to the show. How are you guys today?
We're great.
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no problem. Why don't we just start by introducing yourselves and what your kind of role is on the show? I listened to Still, which I think is your first show, and we'll get into that. So I kind of have an idea, but let's tell the audience kind of what your roles are.
Christine and I used to work together as reporters at the Dallas Morning News and became best friends doing that and just loved hanging out and doing things together. And I started listening to true crime podcasts and thought, wow, I could do this. And she could do this with me. So
what's y'all's roles right now?
So that's how we got into it. And I would say that our roles have been finding the cases, doing the research, doing the writing, kind of the brains behind the operation. As far as the writing goes, mm-hmm. The technical part, that's Gary.
Right. So my role has been, first and foremost, the voice of the podcast. I have a background in performing arts, and I kind of have done that before, so it just kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of digital background, so learning and using editing software was more in my wheelhouse than anyone else's. So it kind of fell into my lap. Christine, do you want to talk about your role?
No, I think Karen covered it. I'm my title, I guess, is associate producer. So I'm like a chief cook and bottle washer person. I just do whatever I'm asked to do. I do, like Karen said, the research and help her with the writing and then some editing. And I got to be a voice in the last one also. That was fun.
Yeah, I heard that. I just finished the last episode this morning and I thought, Gary's passing the reins a little bit. But I thought it was good. So maybe we can just kind of dive into what Reporter's Notebook is, what is Still, kind of explain whoever wants to take that question.
Well, I want to give Christine a chance to answer.
First of all, the Reporter's Notebook, and I might get this wrong, guys, is the podcast arm of Karen and Gary's own multimedia company. So the podcast arm is the Reporter's Notebook, and we settled on a storyline in this last one. We found cases that we wanted to pursue, potential suspect that we wanted to say whether or not he was the one. And so we put the podcast together from that. I don't know how else to explain it.
One of the things with our company, Grace and Shaw Media, we hope to branch out and do all sorts of content creation. And since we're all former journalists, we wanted to do investigative work, and we wanted the Reporter's Notebook to be that brand. And so that's kind of what the Reporter's Notebook is about. Eventually, I foresee us doing potentially, podcasts about, government corruption or, just crime in the streets or just whatever is a compelling story to tell that may not necessarily be true crime or may not necessarily be a cold case. So hopefully, we'll have different podcasts kind of up under that brand, but Still is our first cold case. So how did we land on Still?
The title Still?
Yeah.
Well, we went through, honestly, lots and lots of titles because if you're trying to come up with a name for a new true crime podcast, virtually everything you can think of has already been taken. So it was really difficult. And we were trying not to get overly specific because we thought if we come back with new cases later, we want to still be able to use the same umbrella name. And so we thought, well, these cases are still unsolved. And these families are still hoping, still waiting for answers. So that's how we came up with the name.
Now, the hard question, right? An investigative true crime show. I mean, this is serious business, right? I assume that, you know, you're working on this full time, you have some sort of funding. I mean, this is not, I went to Wikipedia, you know, I Googled a case in my neighborhood, I read the report on a podcast. Can you go into like what led to this creation? Like, did you have a plan? Did you like quit jobs? Like, what happened?
Well, Gary was already out of work. He had been laid off from his job the previous year.
Pre-pandemic, and then the pandemic hit.
Yeah. So he had been looking for a while, and this was just something I was itching to do and wanted to leave my job. And so we just kind of took a leap of faith. I talked to Christine first and said, would you be willing to do this with us? And Christine can talk kind of about what situation she was in at the time. But when she said, yes, I would do it, then I talked to Gary and we said, okay, I'm going to quit my job. And so, yes, we're doing this full time. And as far as funding, we're
self-funded.
Yes. We're our retirement is dwindling right now. So,
wow. So Christine, what were you up to and how did this all come about?
Well, I had recently, when that occurred, moved to New Mexico and with my husband who had retired. And because of that, I kept the job I had in Dallas for several months, but then they couldn't, it's kind of a funny thing about taxes, you know, New Mexico does a state income tax and Texas doesn't. So they couldn't keep me on. And so I ended up losing that job. And so I was sort of semi-retired myself just because of that. And so I had a lot of time on my hands to be able to commit.
The only thing I would add is that, you know, that Karen and I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. We like them. It's kind of, you know, something we're very interested in. And I'll just tell you, there are many times we would finish one and we were like, you know, that was really good, but we think we could do better. I mean, we're journalists, you know, a lot of these people are just armchair sleuths, you know, or yeah, just people who are, hey, I made a podcast. And, you know, I knew we would have to learn the podcasting side of it, but I knew that between the three of us, we already knew how to dig in and do the work. So I was more than confident in our ability to find a story and tell a great story.
Yeah, I don't want to take anything away from people who are, as you said, armchair sleuths, though, because
they do great work.
They do great work. And if you haven't had the training in journalism and know all the tools that we have, it's amazing what they've been able to learn. Absolutely. And uncover. And a lot of these cases have been solved. Not all of them, but a lot of them have. So, you know, I want to give credit where credit's due to all the people out there that are doing this and are doing it with the right motivations to try to help bring closure and solve some of these cold cases.
So one thing I learned maybe the hard way is there are subgenres of true crime. It seems like it goes on forever. One thing I liked about your show, it you know, as soon as I saw it, it was interesting to me immediately because it's a niche that has a high barrier of entry, and it's an investigative true crime that has real investigation, talks to real families, thinks about real things, but also looks at cases that maybe are, you know, at least in Still's case, cold cases. And, you know, you pick a geographic area, at least with that case, to kind of pinpoint. So It checked a lot of boxes. It had locality going for it. It has trained reporters, investigators working on it, which is a very high barrier of entry, right? I mean, that's the biggest barrier of entry is skill. How did you frame how you wanted to start this. And keep in mind, an indie podcaster is probably listening to this thinking, you know, I have a journalism degree. I love true crime. Like, maybe I could do this. Like, what structure that the beginning?
Well, I would say that a lot of it started with Christine and I sitting down and just combing through cases, because we were looking for a case. We knew this is what we wanted to do. And we went in with the idea that maybe we would handle one cold case. And the more we looked into it, the more we said, boy, it's really hard to rule out one case in particular, or rule in one case in particular without ruling in others, because they all seem to be connected. And just, it's, I guess with it, with journalists, it's kind of like the story reveals itself. And that's what happened. I think the more we looked into it, we just kind of said, wow, we really think this is the story that has to be told. And in reality, there were probably more cases we wanted to talk about, but we realized that it was becoming too big of an elephant to try to eat. So we just had to start whittling away and saying, okay, these have the closest connections.
Well, and it would have been too big an elephant for somebody to listen to.
Right.
You have to tell a story that's consumable. If you're building the web, like you see on crime dramas, right, where there's a thousand, strings attached to pictures, like, you can't convey that very well on audio.
I'll give Christine a ton of credit. She's the one who actually found these cases in Fort Worth. And the one thing I will say, Greg, is that I was trying to be, I don't know, the rational guy looking at the bottom line, going, hey, if we found a case close to home, it might be a lot cheaper to produce. So that was my only contribution. But then Christine jumped in and found these cases in Fort Worth.
Somewhat agree with that, but I always think Karen should get some credit there too, because she's the one who found the website that had the cold cases on it.
We disagree on this. I remember Christine finding it, but it, we're both getting a little bit older and our memories are a little fuzzy.
Hey.
Found, but
yeah, well, I've heard the final result. I think there's enough credit to go around for sure. So let's add some context to this. I like to get into the nitty gritty. As Gary will know, I pester him about downloads and what's happening and how's it working and all these things. The show came out in January, essentially. It was December, January was the intro and episode one. How is the show doing today?
As of today, we're above 11,000 total downloads. We're happy about that. Our downloads are starting to improve. Mm-hmm. It's still just not where I want it to be. I just don't think we're getting the exposure at scale that, obviously the big network podcasts get, just because, they're out there. But that being said, I've seen some indie podcasts that are doing a lot better than we are, and I've listened to their work and it's good, but it's not any better than ours. And it's like, we're just not getting our name out there in front of the right people. Now, that being said, that's just me being, I want it all now. But overall, I would say, no, we're growing and things are getting, mm-hmm. We're getting more out there. I'll be honest, being included in your show was a huge bump, that we saw in June. And I shared those numbers with you. So that was a big help.
Awesome. And I hope that it continues to help, because really that's the whole point of Indie Drop-In is if I build a mega show, then I can feature people who deserve to be featured. And the credit kind of goes that direction. I'm not where I want to be yet, because I just make little moves. But hey, one or two listeners, or one or 2,000 listeners, I think is helpful. But maybe we can kind of walk through, what are the largest hurdles for creating a show like this?
Well, I think first we didn't know what we didn't know, so we were, as Gary likes to say, trying to build an airplane while we were flying it. So it's, just learning on the fly, learning what the challenges will be, and trying to figure out what other people were doing and decide, do we like what they're doing or do we not like what they're doing? Mm-hmm. How do we want to do it a little bit differently? And I think a lot of it has been really just providence that things have worked out as well as they have. I guess one of the things you have to keep in mind is that as you're writing episodes, they're going to live on for a long time.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. And you have to keep that in mind as you're writing it. If you're writing it in a serialized form, it's not episodic where this is today's episode. That in a serialized form, you have to tell it in a way that the listeners may be coming to your show a year or two down the road. And things may have changed, things may have happened, and you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think it also kind of feeds into the performance and the downloads. And, you know, I have a lot of author friends, and I think serial podcasts and books have a lot in common, how they're marketed, how they're sold. Basically, what my author friends tell me is when you write your first book, you put it out there and it gets, let's say, 11,000 downloads, just to add context, right? But then what happens is you get book two and book three and book four and book five, and then all of a sudden people start to want to consume the catalog and understand what more things that you make. And, you know, a strategy they employ that I've seen people do in serial podcasts is a rapid release. Right. So you'll put out season one and then season two is already in the can, right? And you'll put it out like 2 months later and you just get the marketing engine in a manner that just doesn't ever stop. I think is that serial podcasts have a disadvantage and an advantage. The disadvantage is that people don't get an episode every week, right? So they can't join the family. They can't join the investigation. They're not interacting with you on Twitter. But that said, they're almost never complete stories like a serial type podcast, like what you make. So whether or not one is better than the other, I think history shows us that serial podcasts outperform, but episodic podcasts, there's way more of them. Who can say what is better? But I think what you're going to find is when you get season two out, your season one downloads are going to skyrocket.
And honestly, Greg, that's kind of one of the things you were going back to talking about a plan. That's one of the things that we talked about was that we wanted to keep the episode count to a reasonable amount. We'd seen some that had 18, 19, 20 episodes, and that just felt a little overwhelming to us. So we wanted to kind of, about 10 episodes we felt was our sweet spot. We wanted to limit each episode to about 35 to 40 minutes, about the average drive time, of a commute. That was a strategic decision. And then we talked about, we also don't want to take 3 years to release our next season. We talked about that up front. And I told the two of them as we were nearing the end of dropping our final episode back in March, I said, okay, it's time. We've got to find the next season because I want to release something by the end of the year. So our goal was to try to get something out every 6 to 7 to 8 months. So that's our goal. And I think we're going to hit it with season two.
Yeah, we're actually working on two seasons kind of simultaneously. We started on one and it has been slow going as far as the investigation because there are some elements we're still waiting to happen. There's a trial that we're waiting to happen.
Yeah.
But then we came across another case and it feels a lot more immediate because we're waiting on DNA results.
Yep.
So we're kind of doing both at the same time and shuffling which one will actually get released first.
Well, we think we know at this point, right?
Yes, yeah.
Most likely.
I think that's really, really smart. So question for Christine, do you treat this like a 9-to-5 job? Because I Gary and Karen, they own the company, right? So it's got to be 24/7 for them. But for you, how do you approach this as far as spending your time and effort? And
that's a great question. I don't really have a schedule. I sort of just do what I need to do when I need to do it. Being semi-retired and having a retired husband means that we have a lot of flexibility, so we can do the fun things we want to do when we want to do them. I sort of just kind of fit in where I can the things that need to be done, which means that I sometimes procrastinate and I shouldn't. I have to push myself a little bit sometimes.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot here for sure.
That's okay.
I just think it's always interesting when there's a team and understanding the team dynamics, especially with remote people and different priorities and all that kind of stuff.
And I want to be clear too, that Christine is not our employee. She's our partner. And, you know, she's not part of Grace and Shaw Media, but she is part of the Reporter's Notebook. So she's our partner, and we all support each other and also kind of, you know, hold each other accountable. That, have you gotten this done? And, you know, can you help me with this? And we're all in this together.
That's amazing.
The best thing that happened recently was we traveled for one of the seasons, and that really increased my interest in the whole process and made me feel more committed to doing things every day and making sure that I was on top of things. So that was a lot of fun. The three of us, it was a long trip. It was really great.
It was incredibly rewarding. Yes.
Well, that's a great segue actually into the next question, because it seems like there would be an extreme amount of logistics involved in what you're doing. I mean, you go to a location, you have people to talk to, schedules to make. I mean, Gary and I, it took us 3 weeks just to plan a half an hour interview. Like, you know, how are you managing the logistics of making this show?
I would say that a lot of times the availability of people dictates our timeline, because we have to find the people, get them willing to talk to us. And we have really been helped by gracious people. The families of a lot of these victims have volunteered information, have volunteered their time. Where we just traveled, the daughter of one of the victims spent a lot of time arranging for us to talk to people. And we didn't even have to worry about it. She just had it kind of lined up. So it was really amazing, rewarding for us, not just to get the cooperation from families, but their help and their advocacy. And they're just really, we're in it because this is interesting to us and it's our job, but they're in it because this is their life. And they've just been really remarkable in how much help they've offered.
I mean, based on what I heard in the show, it seems like a lot of them are still suffering or working through, where are their loved ones? They just don't know anything.
Yeah, that was one of the things in the first season that I think we both kind of learned that we weren't quite expecting, was the response that we would get when we would just call up a family member out of the blue and say, hey, we want to talk about your daughter who died 35 years ago. Sometimes it was pretty negative. That was a difficult thing to deal with, on an emotional human level. Most of the times it was pretty neutral. People were just like, no, I don't really want to talk about that or whatnot. But then a handful of times it was extremely positive. Some people we spoke with were ecstatic to talk. They were just thrilled that somebody cared enough about, their loved one who died 35 years ago. And they've just been our biggest fans. And to me, that's been the most rewarding aspect of it.
I think these types of things, you'll get some media coverage and these things will get the ball rolling. I mean, one thing that people always, I don't know if it's misunderstand or maybe they get into podcasting a little more ambitious than what they should, but it takes years. Like there is no shortcut to time, unfortunately. I mean, you can spend a bunch of money. If you advertise the show, you could definitely get listeners, but the average is in between $2 and $5 per subscriber. You have to sell a lot of ads to pay that back. The surefire way is exactly what you're doing, which is make amazing content, make contributions, provide value over an extended period of time. And then I think what you'll find is before you know it, you'll log on and you'll say, man, why did this go from 325,000 downloads this month, not in total, this month to 360,000? Did we get put, did somebody put us in a blog or something? Like that will happen. Like it absolutely will happen. It'll take a lot of time. It's going to take a couple of years. So I hope that you're ready to
to survive till then.
Yeah, it's delayed gratification. But the one interesting thing about it, though, is it's the exact same amount of work. Like when the thing's getting a million downloads, it's the exact same amount of work as it is today, right? Which is a funny way to think about it, because in any other business, the bigger it gets, the harder it is. You know, the more people you have to hire, all that kind of stuff. If there's a creator, an indie creator looking at creating this type of show, is there a couple of things or one thing that you did wrong that we should avoid, that they should avoid? Yeah. Or if you had the chance to do it over, you would approach it differently.
Everything we did was a learning experience. So even the failures had value, you know. I guess the only thing that we might have done differently was spend a little bit more time in like a pre-planning stage. You know, while they were researching and writing, and we were working on the first season this time last year, it got hot and heavy by September of last year. I mean, they were actively writing by October. And the whole time, I was just working on some of the production value things and whatnot. So, So she asked me at one point, she said, okay, if we're shooting for 35 minutes, how many pages should I write for the script? I don't know. And so we had to do some trial and error to figure that out. You know, she likes her font size at a particular size. She likes to write using this font, blah, blah, blah. I said, just write an episode. I'll go record it and then we'll find out. So I guess, you know, not that that was a mistake or something we would have done differently, but I guess what I would say is if you're going to produce a podcast, is do that kind of trial and error more upfront than we did, I guess.
Yeah, I would say allow yourself time. Don't promise that you're going to have an episode out before it's really, really ready. The first episode we wrote, we went back and changed because we realized we were biting off more than really anybody could digest in one episode. It was too complicated of a story to try to tell the way we wanted to tell it. I think we were talking about the first four victims in the first episode, and we realized at that point, okay, we need to slow down and take our time because we've been immersed in these cases for months now, but our listeners haven't. So they've got to understand what we understand.
Right.
So we had to kind of rejigger it a little bit and figure out how to tell the story a little bit more slowly.
One of the things I think of when I think of mistakes is, and these aren't, like Gary said, not really mistakes, they're learning opportunities. But what I think of is the sound quality, because in the very beginning, we didn't even know how a room should be arranged so that the sound was optimum. And so it's funny, but I was moving in an RV for months during this early part of the process. And I actually tried recording in the RV, which turned out to be disastrous because of the tinny sound. And you know, I had some good equipment, but it just wasn't the right place to do it. So that was a learning experience.
Wow. So where do you do it now?
We've learned that the best place to do our actual recording is in our master bedroom closet, because all the clothes absorb the echoes and things like that.
It is a natural sound booth.
I mean, yeah. And because we have a big dog who barks very loudly.
As you've heard.
We have to put many doors between us and him.
One of the other biggest challenges that, you know, talking about things that we learned, is we had to figure out how to record on the phone the best way possible. Because with the pandemic going on, which was pretty much hot and heavy this time last year, we had to do almost everything on the phone. And, you know, as a journalist, I hated that. I just hated it. And as a podcaster, I even hated it more. You know, I wanted the good quality sound of a face-to-face interview, and we couldn't do that. So that was a challenge as well.
Right. And fortunately for us in Texas, the privacy laws, or I guess, is it privacy law, consent for doing a phone interview is that you don't have to ask permission to record the call. So if somebody said something really valuable before we had gotten their permission, we were able to use it. Although we, you know, we really don't want to use somebody's recording without their permission.
Correct.
But it's important for podcasters out there to understand that there are laws in different states. And if you're calling someone in a different state, that state's laws will apply to the phone call.
Well, that's really great. One thing I do want to touch on, and we're not going to have time to dig too deep. So, when you're out field recording, what type of equipment do you use? What do you bring with you? And you don't have to go too deep, because what I want to get is I'll get an equipment list from you and we'll put it in the show notes, but just maybe the highlights just for creators wondering.
I guess that falls on me to answer then. ironically enough, like I said, with our first season, almost everything was done on the phone. So we didn't have much need for field recording. I bought a couple of Shure SM58s that I used for our voiceover work here in the closet. But anyway, when we were getting ready to go to Oregon, I told her and Christine both, I said, I need to get a good mic. You know, we're going to be out in the field and I need a good mic. I don't want to be running around, you know, like Bob Barker with sticking a mic in people's face. And so, I did a lot of research. This was back at the beginning of July, end of June, I guess. Did a lot of research and ended up buying an Audio-Technica shotgun mic, bought a boom, you know, bought a dead cat to put it in, the whole windscreen, all of that. I did as much research as I could. I'm not an audio professional. We didn't spend a ton of money, but we didn't cheap out either. So we bought, I was pretty pleased with a pretty good quality mic, and it saved us when we were in Oregon. It absolutely saved us. We would have been in trouble without it, I think.
Although Christine was able to get some really good audio on her iPhone using that external mic.
Right.
What's the external mic?
I bought a Shure external mic last year that, you know, connects into your iPhone. And I've used it on a couple of occasions. Christine was able to use it while we were up there. And man, it does a great job just for a little, you know, handheld.
Yeah, I've seen some microphones that connect to the bottom of an iPhone. Like their Zoom makes one. Sure, like you said, Shure makes one. And I'm just always shocked by them. Like, it's just unbelievable what you can do on an iPhone.
That shotgun mic was the big one. And the other one that we've had that we've just used has been the best purchase that we made was a little Zoom H4n recorder. That Joker has been awesome. I've used it for everything.
Yeah. The Zoom recorders, they're just the best. Like, they're small. You can take them anywhere. They run on batteries. You can plug them in. I mean, they just do anything.
We were in Oregon and she was going to go into the police department with one of our sources. And I said, here, and I just whipped it off and I said, stick this in your purse and just see what happens. And ultimately she got some great audio. We may or may not be able to use it, but it was guerrilla audio, and it was awesome. I mean, Christine and I sat out in the car and she walked in and with just a Zoom sticking out of her purse. And so
that's like a movie. It's unbelievable.
Kind of.
All right. So, we're a little bit over, maybe we can start wrapping it up. If you could give an indie podcaster just a little bit of advice about creating a true crime show, maybe doing investigation, anything that you think might be helpful, just one little nugget.
Well, I'll just say from my perspective, because I approach this more as a journalist than I do as, I guess, a professional podcaster, because I don't have the skills, I think, to do the audio or the editing or things like that. But I would say you've got to be careful about verify, verify, verify. If somebody tells you something, try to find another source that can either verify it or disprove it. And keep checking. Don't take somebody's word for it. And people's memories are faulty. So try to get as many sources to back this up, because it's your reputation you're putting at stake when you put information out as a fact.
I would say, just from a technical standpoint, buy a Zoom recorder. It is, if that's all that you can afford, they're like $300, depending on how many bells and whistles you want. But if that's all you can afford, you can produce a great podcast with nothing but that.
Awesome.
And I think I would say that be as unbiased as you possibly can when you're covering a story. You need to give both sides if possible. And then you can, I mean, that comes from my journalism background also. It's, you know, it's, you don't want somebody coming to you and saying, well, you can't, you told that story so slanted that it, you know, doesn't make any sense or whatever.
Yeah. You were obviously biased or something. Mm-hmm. When I look at true crime shows that submit to me, I look at their comments, and whenever there's lots of those comments in the description, I'm a little bit weary about it. All right. So why don't we give the Still fans a little love out there? Tell us what we can expect from season two, and then tell us where to find your show.
Okay. It's hard to give a little bit of information without revealing everything.
Yeah, no spoilers.
But I will say season two really is the story of two cases and how they intersect. There is a Jane Doe and there's a missing woman who is presumed to have been murdered. And the question is, are these in fact the same person? We're still working on that, getting those answers.
That is amazing. That, well done. Like, I got goosebumps over here. All right. So tell us where to find Still, Reporter's Notebook, any information you want to give. Now's the time.
Yeah, we're available on any podcasting platform. We recognize that just searching for Still pulls up a million different podcasts. My recommendation is always to search for Still ... That seems to help quite a bit. If you can't find us there, search for The Reporter's Notebook. And if you can't find us there, then use our RSS feed and ping me on Twitter, and I'll be glad to send it to you.
Perfect. And I'll put all the links in the show notes below to make it super easy for everybody to find the show and you know, your website, social media, all that good stuff. We're just going to load the show notes up with tools and tips and everything that all the nuggets we got from this interview, which there are so many. So I'm going to listen back and write them all down. Christine, Karen, Gary, amazing interview. I really love your show. I think season two is going to be a big hit. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Karen, Gary, and Christine for coming on the show and teaching us all about how to create and run an investigative true crime podcast. I'll put the links to their show, plus everything we talked about, in the show notes below, so if there's anything interesting, you can easily find it. If you're a podcast creator and you're looking to grow your show, you should check out indiedropin.com/creators for a chance to submit your show and be featured on one of Indie Drop-In shows. If you like this podcast, make sure to hit follow. We interview lots of other podcast creators, so don't forget to check out our other episodes. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.